You're listening to Everybody Pulls the Tarp, the go-to podcast for high performers. I'm Andrew Moses. Each week, you'll hear my thought-provoking conversations with Olympians, pro athletes, CEOs, elite coaches, best-selling authors, and other high performers to uncover their secrets to success. Get ready to be inspired each week when we talk about leadership, teamwork, work ethic, and more. Are you ready? Let's go. This week, my guest is Amy Morin. Amy is an acclaimed psychotherapist, international best-selling author, and host of the Mentally Stronger podcast. And her story is unlike any you've ever heard before. When Amy was just 23 years old, her mother died suddenly from a brain aneurysm. At the time, Amy had just recently started her career as a therapist, passionate about helping others navigate life's challenges and build their own mental strength. After her mom passed away, Amy took a few weeks off to privately deal with her own grief. As she puts it, "I knew I couldn't be effective at helping other people unless I was able to productively deal with my own feelings." Amy returned to work a few weeks later, continuing to navigate her new reality of life without her mother. And then, just 3 years later, tragedy struck again. Amy's husband passed away suddenly from a heart attack on the very same weekend that she and her family honored the three-year anniversary of her mother's passing. Suddenly, now at 26 years old, Amy was a widow, and just 3 years removed from losing her mother as well. Amy was battling unimaginable grief, and at one of the lowest points of her life, decided to write a list to herself about all the things mentally strong people don't do. Originally, she intended for the list to just be for her, but she thought about it more and realized that the list had the potential to help others as well. So she published it online, and it went viral. The list struck a chord deeply with people across the globe, and that list highlighting 13 things mentally strong people don't do that she originally wrote for herself has now been read over 50 million times. Amy eventually expanded the list into a book, 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, which is now an international bestseller. She has also since published more books on mental strength, including 13 Things Mentally Strong Parents Don't Do, 13 Things Mentally Strong Women Don't Do, 13 Things Strong Kids Do, and more. And this past December, Amy published her latest book, 13 Things Mentally Strong Couples Don't Do. In all, Amy's books have sold over 1 million copies worldwide and have been translated into over 40 languages. She's also delivered one of the top 15 TEDx talks of all time, a TEDx talk that has been viewed over 22 million times. Well, any way you look at it, Amy's story is remarkable. She turned her unimaginable grief into a quest for lifelong learning and a platform to help others. Amy and I recently sat down to explore her work, and she shared so many powerful tools and strategies that all of us can use to build mental strength and become more resilient in our own lives. The conversation you are about to hear is one that I will be thinking about for a very long time to come. It's raw, vulnerable, and packed with ideas that have the power to change all of our lives for the better. I am so grateful that Amy and I crossed paths, and I hope you take away as much from this conversation as I did. So, let's pull the tarp and get straight to Amy Morin. Where I want to begin, Amy, I want you to take me back to that moment you ultimately decided to take that letter you had written to yourself and publish it online. You've said that you published it because you thought it might help others. And I'm curious, like when you think back to that moment, was there doubt creeping into your mind that, you know, this might be a little too vulnerable to share, or I don't really know how this is going to go? Obviously, you didn't know that it was going to be a viral success, read over 50 million times, and essentially change your life, as you put it. I'm just curious, what were some of your thoughts and maybe some of the downsides of potentially sharing something so vulnerable?
But you know, when I shared it, nobody knew it was a letter to myself. I didn't put any context. It was pretty much, here's a list of 13 things mentally strong people don't do with the things. So then when it went viral and people figured out I was a therapist, I was getting calls from people all over the planet, like literally MTV in Finland called and CNN in Mexico and Fox News, Forbes, all of these people were calling me and they assumed, oh, you're a therapist. So you mastered these things. And at first I didn't tell anybody. There's video footage where I was interviewed on TV and they're like, this is great. These are things that you learn because you're a therapist, right? And I just said, yep. And my biggest concern at that moment wasn't anything about building a career, writing a book. None of that was on my radar. My biggest concern was, is this going to affect my work as a therapist? I worked in a very small town in rural Maine, and the only two therapists who worked there are myself and my sister, who had an adjoining office from mine. And I thought, boy, I'm putting all of this stuff out there. I'm now in the media. Is that going to affect what people talk to me about when they come into my therapy office? What if somebody sees me on TV? And that was my bigger concern. And then Psychology Today, whom is very well respected, wrote this article. Somebody who wrote for them wrote an article about what was wrong with my list. And so I remember having this moment where I thought, I think I've just ruined my career with this article. It turned out okay. Psychology Today actually offered me a job and I got to write a book and do all of this cool stuff. But in that moment, that wasn't on my radar. And I really had no plans of sharing the backstory until a literary agent got me a book deal. And they said, you don't have to share your story, but it might lend more credence if people know why you wrote it, because you struggle with it, not just because you've mastered it.
Why do you think it, and I'm sure you've had years now to think about this. Why do you think it resonated? In particular, we know the book resonated with people, right? I mean, international bestseller. Why do you think that initial article that you wrote and published on, or the letter to yourself, the article that you published online, why do you think that resonated with people so deeply?
I think it was a few things. I think it was the number 13, which people say to me, did you do that on purpose? And the answer is no. I just, again, it was a letter to myself. But I think the number 13 intrigues people. I think the fact it was about what not to do, it was one of the, I'd never seen an article about what not to do. Of course, since then, many more people have made about what successful people don't do and what happy people don't do. But it was one of the first ones about what not to do. And I think that gave people a different way of thinking. And also, nobody was talking about mental strength. So nobody knew what it was. And when we talked about what it means to be mentally strong, and there's still a lot of misconceptions about it and questions people have. And I believe it was that combination. And people were sharing it over and over is how it went viral, because I had celebrities sharing it on Facebook and all sorts of influencers on Twitter, now known as X, who were sharing it. And I think it was because they just wanted to say, like, hey, just don't do these things, or I don't do these things in my life, or I do five of these things. And people just, I think, learned about themselves from the article. And when people look at something and then it gives them insight about who I am, they then want to share it to the rest of the world of like, oh, look, here's some insight into who I am as well.
I think there is something powerful, Amy, in the idea of like what not to do, right? It seems like for the most part, every list that you see, every book that's published is like, do this, do that, do this, do that. Here's the roadmap. And I've had a lot of conversations both on the podcast and throughout my life more recently about this idea of using the phrase like anti-goals. People are talking now a lot about anti-goals. Like, you know, if you're a business leader, instead of talking just about what we want to accomplish, what are the things that are going to impede us from getting to where we need to go? I just had a conversation with an elite college volleyball coach who said the same thing. She said, we sit at the beginning of a season and we map out all the different points of adversity that could pop up. And she said, the only thing that's guaranteed is that we're not going to identify everything that might pop up, and that some of the things that we plan for are not going to happen. But when it does, we're better equipped. Is there science and research behind why it's harder for people to focus on the things that like you shouldn't do and the bad habits, as opposed to like all this information and thought leadership out there about these are the habits you need to form?
Well, for me, because I felt like I was at the bottom of the barrel in that moment of my life, the last thing that would have been helpful would have been a to-do list. I felt like there's a million things I could do to work on myself, but it just feels overwhelming when you're struggling. And as a therapist, I knew, like, okay, I'm supposed to build on people's strengths. That's what I learned in college. When people come in and they tell me about all the great things they're doing, I build on those. Like, oh, that's amazing. You're already doing this. Let's keep doing more of that. But at some point early on in my career, I figured out, well, that's ridiculous. If you have one or two bad habits, I'm not going to ignore those. Like if I went to a physical trainer and they said, lift weights and run on the treadmill, like I'd do it. But I'd be really mad if they didn't tell me that the junk food I ate on the drive to the gym was outdoing it. So like, let's work smarter and not harder. And obviously, you didn't want to walk through life in those little moments thinking like what not to do. So for instance, if I'm a baseball player and I step up to the plate and I just keep thinking, don't strike out. And I say that over and over again, don't strike out, don't strike out. Well, then I'm focused on not striking out. And guess what? I've just increased the chances that I'm going to strike out. So in those little moments, you want to focus on what to do so you can teach your body, your brain to work together and do the action that you want to see. But on the overall picture of life, there are so many things to do that we often feel like we're just running around like a chicken with our head cut off. So if you can wake up and say, hey, just don't do this thing today, I guarantee you already have good habits, but that's how you make them more effective, is you cut out the one or two that are keeping you stuck.
Is there a formula that you feel like is the right amount? Like I should spend 75% of my time talking about the habits I want to form and 25% of the time working on eliminating the bad habits that I want to avoid. Like, is there a formula that people listening can say, you know what, this is the right amount I should be thinking about?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't have the exact formula, but I think just knowing what your weaknesses might be and then figuring out like, what do I not want to do today? So we'll take feeling sorry for yourself. When you are going through a tough time and you can say, all right, I feel awful and maybe life really is bad. And I know I'm going to do all of these things today, whether it's I'm going to get up and get out of bed, I'm going to write in a journal, I'm going to make 5 phone calls. And your biggest goal might just be that one thing of, I'm going to focus on not feeling sorry for myself. Or maybe it's the salesperson who says, 80% of the calls I make are not going to work out, but I'm going to keep going anyway, because I'm not going to feel sorry for myself with each rejection. So I think every day, if we just picked like, what's the biggest thing I could avoid doing today to make it okay, so that all of these other things I'm doing are effective, I think that would work out well.
That does seem like a strategy that I know I can put into use both personally and professionally. So I want to get to your book. As I mentioned, 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. I remember walking into the bookstore and literally I went to the back and I said, okay, here are the things. They don't waste time feeling sorry for themselves. Okay, I was like, I don't do that. I do that a little bit. And then I said, don't give away your power. I was like, I don't think I do that. Don't shy away from change. Like, I'm pretty receptive to change, but like some things, the don't focus on things you can't control. Like, I definitely struggle with that. So I'm like, okay, I got to go to chapter 4. Don't worry about pleasing everyone. I think I got that under control. Don't fear taking calculated risks. This was like one I was wrestling with. I couldn't figure out whether I'm a risk taker or I'm risk averse. And I feel like in different parts of my life that, I'm looking at the book and the back of the book and I'm saying to myself, all these things seem simple, but not easy. And I actually think that like a lot of success in life, whatever you're trying to do, actually comes down to like doing simple things, but simple things that are not easy to do. And I'm curious, how can, regardless, and we'll get into some of these specific ones, and I've got specific questions for you, but like when you think about it globally, on the surface, it's a lot of simple things. How can people do more simple things effectively?
Oh, that's a great question, because you're absolutely right. And as a therapist, that's often what I help people do. They come into my therapy office because they've been struggling with depression or anxiety or PTSD. And we'll say, let's go back to the basics. Like, how's your diet? Are you sleeping? Are you getting exercise? And it's those little things that we all know, like, all right, these things are important. But when we're struggling with something, they're often the first thing that we set aside because we think, but no, I have to do all this other stuff right now, or I have to focus on that. And we forget it. So a great strategy for life is just asking yourself, like, I know this stuff, like inherently, I know, how do I go back to the basics? And that can be one of the best ways to empower yourself to say, what am I going to do today? How am I going to spend my time? How am I going to dig myself out of this giant hole? Maybe you've dug yourself into a huge hole, or you found yourself in a really difficult situation. Just remind yourself, go back to the basics. And when people who are really depressed start saying, okay, I'm going to go for a walk twice a day around the block, that's really tough to do when you're depressed. But getting outside, being in nature, moving your body, those simple things that can make a huge difference. So when people start doing those things, even if they don't necessarily believe it in the moment, but you have that faith of, I'm going to try it anyway as an experiment. And then they can say, in 2 weeks, I'm going to check in. Did this make my life better or worse? And I've never had anybody who say, you know, walking around the block twice a day made my life worse, so I'm going to quit it. But once they saw for themselves, okay, maybe this does give me a little more energy or helps me feel a little bit better, then they're much more likely to keep going.
So Amy, number 3, they don't shy away from change. So this was one, for me, I love doing new things. I love taking on new challenges, but I've found more and more that I've kind of discovered about myself is that I like routine and change is a little bit hard for me. So how do you balance this idea of wanting to take on change and push yourself and push your boundaries, but also like there's been benefits reported on routines and habits and like creating things that you do with regularity, you know, and I'm one of these people that if I work out 3 days in a row, like there's a really good chance I'm going to work out on the fourth day. But if I am traveling the next day and it doesn't happen, like there's a really good chance that the next day I'm not going to work out. Like I'm a very like habitual person. So how do you balance both like the benefits of habits and routines with also challenging yourself to push your boundaries and seek change?
Oh, I'm all for having as many automatic habits as you can. Decision fatigue is a real issue. And we know that people get worn out even by mid-afternoon. People tend to make poorer decisions. And this is true for like all professions. When they look at doctors and judges and everything, they be seen in the morning if you have to go to court or you have to go to an appointment because they make poor decisions by afternoon because their brain's tired. So I'm all for figuring out how do you make these automatic habits just part of your everyday life. The things you want to do regularly, like maybe go to the gym, or you think I need to spend more time with friends because I'm getting a little bit isolated. Maybe your Saturday morning routine is you go out for coffee with your friends. So those sort of good habits, automate them, but then always be open to like, what could I try differently? And then be really proactive about it. So even if we said working out, maybe you think, okay, I do. I work out after work every day and I feel pretty good. Maybe you want to experiment though in the morning. Maybe working out before you go to work gives you more energy during the day and helps you sleep better. So you decide, I'm going to try that as an experiment for a couple of weeks and see, does it make my life better, worse, or the same? And then you can make the decision about whether to adopt that habit. So I would say it's really about being proactive, taking a step back, sometimes looking at the bigger picture, and then being intentional about the changes that you want to make, while at the same time knowing that you could have the best plan in the world and life will throw you some curveballs. But you have to stay loose so that you know that when things don't work out the way you intended, that you have the confidence that, okay, I can handle this and that it's not going to be as catastrophic as my brain predicts it could be.
My brain always focuses on the downside risk more than the potential upside. Like what's more common and like, am I in the majority and how do I navigate that?
And you're in the majority and it's because your brain's trying to protect you, right? Your brain doesn't want you to go out there and embarrass yourself. And sort of from a biological standpoint, if you go do something and it's really far-fetched, you might get isolated. Well, back in the day when you lived in a cave, you needed other people to also be your hunters and gatherers with you. So it makes sense that our brains are kind of hardwired for the negative. And that's not a bad thing. It's just about knowing, all right, my brain's pretty good at pointing out risks. And then getting to know yourself well enough to know, and my brain maybe exaggerates how risky something is, or it focuses on the specific risks. And you referenced this before, that some risks are easier than others. And sometimes people will take a physical risk without thinking twice, but a social risk, heck no, that's too scary. So again, just knowing the biases that you have, the way your brain functions can help you make better decisions. It's the people that never look at risk at all that frighten me the most. The people that are like, somebody called with this get rich quick scheme. Like, how could it possibly go wrong? I'm definitely going to make... And then they make these decisions based on their emotions and they get excited about things and it's their excitement that clouds their judgment. And it's harder to teach those people of, wait, back up for a minute. This isn't just about being positive. This is also about being impulsive or making decisions that don't pan out in the end. And we don't want people to think, gee, my life's all messed up and it's not my fault. Sometimes it's about the decisions that you make and not recognizing the risks that you're taking.
How do you know? And maybe this is a learned skill that just you develop over time, but like, how do you, or can you know when there's too much emotion baked into a decision?
Yeah, that's a great question as well. So we know we make our best decisions when our emotions and our logic are in balance. If we were always doing things that were based on emotion, we'd sit and eat chocolate cake. You wouldn't go to work. You'd do whatever feels good right in the moment. But on the other hand, if you lived an incredibly logical life, it would be incredibly boring. You wouldn't go after your dreams or fall in love or do some of the things that make life worth living. So it's about finding that balance. But if an opportunity comes your way, it's important to take your emotions into consideration and think, what am I feeling right now? And just put a name to it. And if you can say, okay, I'm nervous, I'm really anxious, labeling it takes some of the sting out of it. But it can also then help you figure out, well, and how does anxiety normally cloud my judgment? When I'm anxious, I only focus on the potential negative outcomes. So then what might be some of the potential positive outcomes? And you sit down with a piece of paper and you can balance that out so that you say, all right, here are 10 bad things that could happen, but here are 7 good things that could happen. And seeing it on paper is one of the best ways to balance our emotions with logic. And then just learning about yourself and how your feelings affect you. We know statistically something like anger and embarrassment makes people take big risks. So when somebody fails at something and they're angry, they're much more likely to take a huge risk next because they think, I might as well go for it, or I've already ruined this. What else could possibly go wrong? Or when we're sad, like you should never negotiate when you're sad. Don't go buy a used car on a day when you're feeling kind of down, because statistically you won't negotiate very well. You'll be like, I'll give you 10 grand for that. And they come back with 12 grand and you say, okay, rather than saying 11, because you're worried that your ego can't handle it. So I think knowing, all right, how do I pay attention to my emotions? I'm going to name my feelings, figure out what those feelings are, take some time to think, how could this be clouding my judgment? Write some stuff down on a piece of paper to get the flip side of it, and then try to balance out those emotions with logic.
The writing down is something that I'm going to have to put into action. All of my notes that I take for anything, handwritten notes, I read, as I've held up now a few times, like I read hard copy books, I write notes in the margins. It's really hard for me to learn when, like, I'm typing or doing things like that. So I have to believe that a lot of that you shared is going to help me. And I'm going to try the writing things down in those moments. Amy, another thing, kind of in just sticking on this change idea, another thing that I know a lot of people wrestle with, and I know that I wrestle with from time to time, is the idea that, like, it almost feels like it's never going to be the perfect time. When people want to enact some big change, I know I have battled this. It's like, well, I got this going on. This is really stressful right now. This is a challenge right now. At the end of the day, it's like never the right time. And I would imagine that's like a universal rule of thumb in terms of like making bold change. And there's one of my favorite proverbs. I think it's like the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The next best time is right now. So how do you think about balancing that, right? Like making sure that you're taking a bold risk, you're taking action at a time that's conducive for success, but you're also not in this like analysis paralysis mode where you're waiting for the perfect time that is never going to come.
Yeah, I see a lot of that where people will say, well, the timing wasn't right, so I didn't do it yet. Or I don't feel ready, so I'm not going to take action. So I think it really goes back to figuring out, like, what's my goal here? And how would I know when I was ready? So if somebody says, you know, I'm thinking about switching jobs, but I haven't really done it yet. It's normal to be ambivalent. So then maybe you figure out, what are the consequences of staying put? If I don't ever apply for a new job, what's the downside of that? And then what's the upside of looking for a new job? Again, this is about increasing your motivation, talking yourself into doing something. And that's a great way to do it, is you write the cons of not taking action and the pros of taking action. Sometimes that helps move people up the chain a little bit. So they say, all right, I'm feeling a bit more ready to do that. And then I think it's just accepting that there is never going to be the perfect moment to do something, and you don't have to feel 100% ready to take action. We often get our actions confused with thoughts and feelings, but to know, I could still have some doubt, I could still be feeling kind of anxious about this, but I'm going to take one step. It doesn't have to be a giant leap. Usually you can take one small step. And what's one small step I could take today to get a little bit closer to that thing? But a lot of people struggle with something like a difficult conversation with somebody. Like, the person was in a bad mood today, so I didn't have that conversation. And then the next day, they're like, well, they were in a great mood today. I didn't want to ruin the mood, so we didn't have that conversation. So if you find yourself in that place where today's not a good day and then tomorrow's not a good day, just saying, all right, well, I'm going to do it. There's never a perfect time, and accepting it, that you're going to make the move. You're going to follow through with something, and that's okay if it wasn't the exact right time.
One of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately, Amy, is this idea of like little like nudges, like subtle little things. Like too often we think about something as like we're navigating this cruise ship and you have to like turn it 90 degrees in just one moment. When I think a lot of life is like these subtle nudges, little small bites. And I'm thinking back to a conversation that I had with Shay McGee. Shay McGee is the founder of Studio McGee, one of the fastest growing interior design companies in the United States. She's also the host of the hit Netflix show, Dream Home Makeover. And Shay and I had a conversation about her career, but it morphed into this really, really cool conversation about how like design is really not that different from life. And she talked about this example of, she's like, Andrew, I fundamentally believe that like one item from Target for your home or your dorm room can fundamentally change your whole outlook on life. And I can shift a lamp. She's like, I've proven to my clients that I can move a lamp an inch or two and change the way the entire room looks. And that's just been like a metaphor for life that I've been thinking about. And hearing what you said there, I think you believe that too.
I do. There are very few like changes we would make that are permanent. 99.9% of the time, you just go back if it didn't work out. But we often think, oh, I got to spend 4 years talking myself into this thing, and then I'm going to take this giant leap. And then a week later, you think, well, that didn't work out. But just knowing almost all of these changes we make in life start with like a really small step. And that step might be, I'm going to research something. I'm going to make 3 phone calls. I'm going to look into something. I'm just going to take this bold idea and I'm going to try to change it into something that's workable for me today. And when we do that, like it makes this huge shift in our mindset too. So you don't have to feel brave to act brave, but you start to act brave and it shifts the way that you see yourself. And pretty soon the feelings follow. So take the action first sometimes. And then you think, oh yeah, I'm more capable and competent than I thought that I was.
I'm amazed at how just progress creates confidence, and then confidence kind of encourages more action. There's so much in this book that I've taken so much from. So another one I want to hit on, they don't focus on things they can't control. So I definitely spend a lot of time focusing on things that I can't control. And in the book, one of the lines that I underlined, you say, making demands, nagging, and begging won't yield the results you want. Share opinions and concerns, but only share it once. I feel like this is something I'm like pretty bad at. Like I'll constantly just like repeat my viewpoint, hoping that it'll either be heard differently or it'll land a different way. So I guess, diagnose me. Why is that? Why do I think that way? Why do I act that way? And like, what's the best way for me to like fight that urge and be better in that regard?
Yeah. So you probably see that potential in people, mistakes that you think that they're making. You're trying to make people better. But what we know from the research is that it's unlikely that somebody's going to change their behavior based on the words coming out of your mouth. And instead, people believe the words coming out of their mouths. So if somebody comes into my therapy office and I say, hey, you shouldn't smoke cigarettes because that's bad for you. Well, this isn't a news flash to them. Like nobody smokes cigarettes because they think it's good for them. But they then say to me, yeah, but I have to because it helps me manage my stress better. That has just reinforced to them that smoking is a really good idea because now their brain is focusing on all the positive aspects of smoking. And statistically, they're much more likely to smoke even longer or smoke more cigarettes. So the goal becomes, how do I make the words coming out of this other person's mouth say that cigarettes are a bad idea? And so in research studies, they'll say, hey, this 8-year-old over here is thinking of picking up smoking. What do you think? And then the smoker says, don't do it. It could ruin your entire life. And they start naming all the reasons why an 8-year-old shouldn't smoke cigarettes. That makes them much more likely to quit smoking, because they believe the words coming out of their mouth. So when it comes to dealing with other people, if there's a change that maybe somebody's on the fence, gosh, I was thinking about doing this, but I don't know. Or somebody maybe even says, no, I don't think this is a problem, or I'm going to keep doing this. If you have concerns about it, then you ask questions like, oh, tell me more about this. What would happen if you didn't do that? And we often look for what's called wishes or dips. So anybody, even if they have a behavior that they're doing something that is incredibly destructive to us in our view of it, but they look at it as, no, this is just what I do. Maybe I have diabetes and I eat the chocolate cake every day. They will still have moments where they might say, oh, you know, I don't feel that well. That's a dip in their motivation. And then you might say, well, what do you think is causing you to not feel so well? They might say, probably the chocolate cake. And then that's your opportunity to ask more questions so that the words coming out of their mouth are things that they would talk them out of it. On the flip side, they're probably going to have wishes. So somebody might, let's say this is somebody with diabetes who's eating tons of junk food, might say, ah, I wish I didn't have to take so much medicine all the time. That's a wish. So then you dive in and say, that's interesting. I could imagine it's a pain to take all this medicine all the time. What do you think you'd have to do? Or what kinds of things might help with that? And then they might say, well, if I manage my blood sugar better with my diet, then I wouldn't have to take so much. And then you can have that conversation about, oh, that's interesting. And the last thing you want to do in that moment is then say, yeah, obviously you should go see a doctor. Because then you flip the switch and it's you telling them what to do. You want those words to come out of their mouths. And so as a therapist, I have plenty of people who end up in therapy, not because they wanted to, but because maybe their spouse drew the line and said, go to therapy or else, or they have a judge who says, you need anger management. They come into my office saying, well, I don't have a problem. Everybody else thinks I do. My job then is to help them figure out, well, why might other people think you have a problem? Is there anything you want to do about it? This person might not want to change their whole life, but sometimes they say some things that then might make them think, well, you know, I did get fired from 2 jobs, or I did have this one issue once before, and here's why, and here's what I could do differently next time. And that might just move the needle a little bit so somebody feels a little more motivated to create change. If not right now, maybe down the road.
Is that why so often in therapy journeys, it's so much about the individual's awareness?
Right. People come in and will say things that sometimes don't match up with the words coming out of their mouth, doesn't match up with the behavior or the stories that they tell. So somebody might come in and tell me, like, oh, I'm an incredibly loyal person. But then they also tell me that they cheated on their last partner and that they have been applying for 17 jobs despite not telling their boss they're looking for work. Or they might say, oh, I'm honest, I would never lie. And then there's a story about how they cheated on their taxes last year. So my job is often to help people see that maybe the labels that they've placed on themselves or the labels other people have placed on them might no longer fit. Somebody might have grown up being told, you're the funny one. And as an adult, they feel incredibly sad and they don't like being the funny one anymore. So we have that conversation of like, well, how did that label that you got called when you were 7, how does that still affect you now that you're 40 years old? And what do we do about that? And it's not up to me to point out to people, here are 15 things you should be doing differently. But sometimes it's just about raising their awareness of why they're not feeling as good as they wish that they were, or why sometimes they're still confused about their emotions or their relationships or the problems that they're having.
I think that, and I've been on this long journey talking to so many successful people around the world from all walks of life, Olympic athletes, pro athletes, TV stars, Grammy winners, Instagram influencers, CEOs, entrepreneurs, bestselling authors, you name it, like from every category you could imagine. And what I am finding is that there's a lot of common through lines. Like one of the common through lines is like the ability to be very self-aware, aware of strengths, aware of their weaknesses, and then to have also have this awareness. This is something that I've worked on a lot personally as well, like to have this awareness that like you need to be aware. So like that you might have blind spots and that you need to figure out what those are, even though it's an imperfect science. One of the other through lines, and this is actually something I'm going to go back to the book. This is one when that I kind of consistently feel like I do pretty good. Like it's, you know, what number was this? This was number 10. Don't give up after the first failure. I like never give up. Maybe sometimes to a fault. I will never give up. And I will fail and I will try it again and I will fail and I will try it again. But I know there's a lot of people listening that give up after the first failure or like the first sign of resistance. And one of the things people ask me this, like, what's the biggest learning? Like, you know, from talking to all these successful people. And I tell them, it's hard to distill it down to one. But one of the things that, like in particular, the elite athletes will always tell me is they wish that people understood how much they failed, right? If you're a gold medal figure skater, it's very easy to assume that you had this God-given talent and that you got really lucky and things worked out for you. And they see the 2.5-minute performance and they think that's it. But they don't see the 10,000 times that I fell and all the times that I failed and all the times I didn't want to go to the rink, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So how can people get better at not giving up at the first sign of resistance?
2 things I would say. One is being aware that sometimes when we hold a belief, we'll make it true. So if I say to myself, I'm just not skilled at X, Y, or Z, or I'm not really a good business person, and then I launch a business, the first sign of trouble, I'll probably quit because I'm like, see, told myself I wasn't good at that. So sometimes it goes down to what our deep-rooted beliefs are. And then sometimes, as you say, there is research behind that we only look at people's success stories. there's a study where they took high school science students. And the more that their high school teachers told them about how successful Edison and Einstein and all these other famous scientists were, the more the students' grades declined because they thought these people are geniuses and I don't have that. So therefore, I'm not going to guess. I'm not going to raise my hand or I'm not going to try really hard. So then the teachers flipped this switch and explained all of Edison's inventions that you've never heard of because they were absolute failures, or all of the things and ideas that these other scientists had that didn't work out. And as they talked about that, the students' grades actually went back up because they realized getting an answer wrong didn't mean you're stupid. It just meant that you tried something that didn't work. We can all use that in our own lives. So if you're an athlete, look at the other athletes who have failed and the millions of times that they fell down. If you're a business person, look at all the business stories that didn't work out. And you don't just have to look at the super successful people. You can look at the people at pretty much any level of success and say, oh yeah, the fact that they kept trying, I guarantee it didn't start out easy. And even when it comes to my article, people are like, well, you wrote one article, it went viral and you got a book deal. No, I've been writing articles for years. None of them went viral. It wasn't my first article that I ever wrote. So even when it looks like somebody was an overnight success or that something amazing happened to somebody at their first try, that I guarantee that's not the full story.
I've told this story many, many times on the podcast, but I remember talking to a country music songwriter who now has 18 number one hits. And he said, Andrew, it took me 15 years to become an overnight success.
Right.
And nobody sees. And I talked to a best-selling author recently who commented that people, you know, when she got signed by an agent and then her first publishing deal, they said, wow, you're so young. She was in her early mid-20s. She said, but I've been writing since I was 6 years old.
Yeah.
So I've gotten the proverbial, like Malcolm Gladwell, 10,000 hours while nobody was watching. I've also tried to like learn to kind of like reframe failure into like the best version of itself. And a story that I love, Jim Sonnefeld, who goes by Sony, he's the drummer for Hootie and the Blowfish. And he told me the story about when him and Darius Rucker and the other guys were getting going, they drove 3.5 hours to a gig that three people showed up. And of course, for those who are not familiar with their story, they went on to win 2 Grammys. They've sold over 25 million albums, and they're one of the most iconic bands of certainly of the 90s, but in many senses of all time. And Darius Rucker has gone on to even have a bigger career all by himself as a country artist. And he said to me, he said, Andrew, well, I asked him, I said, so how did you like, where, how do you pick up and move on from that? He says, well, the bad news was that three people showed up and we drove 3.5 hours for this gig. The good news, only three people on the earth knew that only three people showed up for Hootie and the Blowfish's concert. So we just kept going. And I think that's something that since he shared that story with me, that's something that I've been trying to think about as well. What is the best true version of the story that you can tell yourself that will enable you to move forward? It's something that in a lot of aspects of my life, I think I've been pretty good at, but I know there are aspects that I could do better.
And I like that idea of knowing that not that many people know, because that seems to be one of the biggest concerns a lot of people have is like, if I fail, but nobody knows, somehow that doesn't feel so bad. But when it's public, it feels awful. If you think, gosh, you know, I had this business downtown and I had to shutter my doors so the whole world thinks I'm a failure, or I failed at losing weight, I got in shape and then I gained it all back. This is awful. But like in reality, number one, people don't think about you nearly as much as you think that they do. They could really care less. And nobody likes you because you're perfect. You don't have a friend who says, you know what I really like about Andrew? It's that he's never messed up, right? Like people will say, no, I like somebody because they are relatable or because they have stories that I can definitely relate to. So knowing nobody likes you because you're perfect anyway, people don't judge you for failure like you think that they're going to. But the only way to prove that to yourself sometimes is to get out there and try. Prove to yourself that people aren't going to all run the other direction just because you fail.
You have shared so much wisdom. I mean, you always share so much wisdom with the world, you know, in your books, in all your content, on your podcast. I just feel so fortunate for all the time that we've gotten to spend together here. You've been so gracious with your time. You've laid out so many actionable lessons that I know I can put into use in my own life. And I know so many listeners are going to use to affect positive change as well. If we had to distill it down to like one thing as we wrap up, like the most important driver of our mental strength, what is it? Like if there was one thing we were all going to focus on, what would it be?
That it's important to do something you don't think you can do just to prove to your brain that you are more capable and competent than you think that you are. And the only way to do that is to get out there and take action, trying to do things that you probably once thought impossible. And then over time, you train your brain to think differently and you can chip away at some of your core beliefs that are probably keeping you stuck in life.
I'm curious, when you think about like the day that you decided to pursue a career as a therapist and all that has happened since, is the reason that you followed that path still the same? In other words, in 50 years, if someone were to write an article about Amy Morin, what would you want it to say? And is it the same thing you would have wanted it to say when you got into the profession many, many years ago?
Oh, interesting question. I think my goal has just always been like, leave the world a little bit of a better place than where I found it. And I hope that no matter what I do, and whether I had stayed a therapist in rural Maine or I got to write books on a boat in the Florida Keys, I would hope that that's true in any way. Or had I don't know, become a clerk at a store, I would still hope that that would still have been true.
Powerful message, I think, for us to end on, Amy, that no matter what you're doing, we all have an opportunity to leave the world a better place and positively influence the people around us. There is no question you positively impact the people around you that you come in contact with, and so many millions and millions of people around the world. Amy, I am so grateful we've got to have this conversation. I hope we get to have many more conversations down the road. And I just have to say, there is no question you are a certified TARP puller, forever a part of the Everybody Pulls the TARP community, always leading by example, always pushing boundaries, always trying to lift people up for the greater good. Thank you so much, Amy, for this wonderful conversation and spending some time with me this week.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining me this week. Be sure to subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you can catch all of our upcoming episodes. And if you are like me and want a world full of TARP pullers, then leave a review to help others find us. You can also follow me on Twitter at Andrew H. Moses. That's Andrew H. Moses. And be sure to sign up for my email newsletter at everybodypullsthetarp.com/newsletter. I'll share tips and insights to help you achieve maximum success and happiness. Today's a great day to pull the TARP. I am rooting for you. See you next time.